Hello and welcome to Out of the Frame, conversations about photography. I'm Pia Johnson, your host, and this podcast features conversations about photography, creativity, and the world we live in. I'll be talking to other photographers, curators, academics, and researchers about their work, artistic process, and how they feel about contemporary photography today. My guest for today is Jodie Haynes, who is a contemporary artist based in Naarm, Melbourne. She's known for her unique art practice, which combines elements of social practice, photo media, and public art. Haynes is particularly recognised for her large-scale public activations, which she calls her big face in public space work. Her approach is deeply rooted in Indigenous feminist new or known materialism and emphasises yarning, relationality and standpoint as a way to explore themes of identity, representation and the female gaze. Jodie has collaborated with local communities across Australia on projects such as Women Dreaming 2018 for Women of the World and Festival, Gold Coast Commonwealth Games, Our People, Our Place in 2019 for Horizon Festival, and Black 2022 commissioned by Art Centre Melbourne. Haynes has received commissions from organisations such as Creative Victoria, Wyndham City Council and many others. Her work has been featured in key exhibitions such as Tell, Contemporary Indigenous Photography at Sydney Festival 2019, Eye to Eye Photo 2021, and Here I Am, Art by Great Women 2020 to 2021 with Ambush Gallery, a satellite project for Know My Name at the National Gallery of Australia. In 2022, Jodie was awarded the First Nations Creators Grant through Maribyrnong City Council to create a new immersive film and projection work exploring Aboriginal relationality. Her work is included in both public and private collections, such as Wyndham City Council, Maribyrnong City Council, Art Centre Melbourne and Hume City Council. Jodie is also a PhD candidate at RMIT School of Art. Hi, Jodie. Thanks so much for joining me today on Out of the Frame Conversations about Photography.
Thanks for having me, Pia. I just went into my little nervousness. I'm sorry.
You totally shouldn't be nervous. It's such a pleasure to have you on the podcast. And I think you were one of the first people that messaged me, having listened to one of the episodes, saying that you really enjoyed it. So I really appreciate you messaging me that, but also coming on and being a guest, because you have definitely been on my wish list. So it is lovely to have you. I wanted to start by getting you to talk a little bit about your love of photo media, whether it's photography, video or storytelling. And I listened to an interview where you mentioned that you've kind of always been engaged in either art making or working within the arts. But, you know, I'd love you to tell us how you moved in photography or the photo media kind of area.
Yeah, okay, cool. Also, I'll acknowledge firstly that I'm recording this today on Kulin Country on Woiwurrung land, and pay my respects to the elders past and present, and to all Aboriginal people who are listening and Indigenous people who are listening to this. And also everyone's elders who are listening to this. Yeah, so love of photography or photo media. It's an interesting question because it's really hard to pinpoint where that kind of love for something kind of grows. I mean, as a kid, one of my nans, she was constantly videoing everything and so and making photos and showing back those, like, home videos back onto a sheet on the wall with the projector, like, you know, all these bits and pieces. So I guess I was always around that, around video and photography as kind of a form of exchange or sharing. Yeah, and I guess that's where my love for it first came. But it was also where my hatred for it first came as well.
So, yes. Wow. Because of being filmed and being and then having yourself shown to you, like, is that
yeah,
way that...
Yeah, yeah. And it was kind of like it always felt quite... You didn't have a choice in whether you were going to be filmed or part of these processes. Like, you know, you were kind of just there and then on a screen. So it was a very, it was a very, it felt like a rigid tension with that process. Like I loved watching everyone else, but I didn't love watching myself, which was interesting.
Yeah.
And there was also, with the photographs that were made, they were always very staged and everyone had to be happy and there was no kind of natural moments. Like, I mean, everyone's family photos kind of look like that from, you know, certain eras.
Totally.
But it was just kind of, how do you then make photos in a way that kind of relate to each other rather than having someone just sit there as a subject? And so I guess that's where that kind of interrogation came from in my portraiture. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing that I find really fascinating about your portraits and the way you make portraiture, both commercially and for your creative projects, is there is a really deep engagement with your subject and there's a kind of collaborative mode with your subject. And you also mentioned that portraiture can be political. Do you think that's where you've taken, you know, those family portraits and that stagedness, but also that, I guess, everyday connection in how you present and represent yourself into moving it into your own work? How do you feel like, you know, I think portraiture says so much about the photographer as well as the subject. How do you grapple with all that and put it into your work?
Yeah, good question. It's, I mean, that's something that's been a really long process of working that out, how to do it in an ethical manner, how to kind of create works that speak to each person, whether they're in front of the frame or behind the frame or the spectator that's also looking at things. So, I mean, there's that gaze, it's a triangular process. It's not just one way. So, yeah, I guess it's, yeah, it's really about the relationship that's kind of created with that process. So, like, as I said, you know, the relationship of being a child and having that sort of process of being filmed or photographed and not having that choice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really come through in what I do now, and also making sure that everyone kind of is completely invested in the process. So whether that's the person in front of the lens or the person behind the lens. So it's collaborative in that sense. We're creating a relationship. To use an example, like the I Am Woman portrait project, that was all about the collaborative process of creating images together and doing that through a yarning process. So yarning is a form of transference of knowledge, of building relationships, of breaking down those barriers between each other, so kind of also breaking down those hierarchies. And I completely admit you've always still got hierarchies happening when there's, you know, someone behind the camera, but it's making sure that you're making that kind of distance between those two levels or two situations lessened, so that people are having more of a kind of I'm not explaining this well, but they have more of a sort of ownership over the process, I guess.
An agency, and maybe?
Like, yeah, agency is exactly the word, yeah.
Yeah. But also, I mean, how long is your, like, I guess I'm not familiar with the yarning process in terms of what you're, like, I mean, I guess I chat to my subjects when I'm photographing them to make them comfortable, but to learn a little bit more about what they're doing or what they're on about. But, I mean, I Am Woman was a massive project where you photographed, was it like 80 women or something like that? It was a huge amount of work and over a long time. So was the yarning process something that, was it a couple of hours or was it a day or was it a week? Like, how did that duration work within your yarning process for that project?
Yeah, that one I was quite flexible in that kind of time duration. So I kind of played around with different time durations because it was, I guess, really something that that project was informing my methodology going forward for my PhD process. So I did short durations, like as in 30 minutes, and then there was like a couple of hours, and then there was like, you know, 40 minutes, or then there was an hour. So there were, it kind of worked differently. But what I did have in that process was a selection of loose questions to ask, and that project was all about representation and feminism. And so it was about women being seen, or people who identify as women being seen in a way that they're kind of in control over. So that moment of making that portrait that was put out was really at the very last moment of our conversations. So I'd be clicking away, obviously, to get people used to the light and the sounds and the feeling of having that camera there. But we're yarning, we're talking, we're crying, we're having cups of tea, we're doing lots of, you know, relational processes of getting to know each other, but also unpack our kind of biases and our understandings and just where we're positioned and what we see in the world around us. So that was kind of a really beautiful process. So I set up these kind of structures and parameters around how to have that conversation and then just let it fluidly roll, which was kind of really nice. So that's
really
last
beautiful
moment, that last moment of making those photographs, that really comes from a moment where the person who is collaborating with me has that kind of really still, settled moment where they just ground themselves, they think about a certain moment. I won't kind of disclose any of those processes because it's always behind closed doors. And then they give me the indicator, like the time to make the images. So I'll do 5 frames post that moment where they've given me permission to make the image. So that's...
Yeah, wow. Kind of,
yeah, so that's where that came from. And I've always kind of interrogated what is that 5 frames about? But
yeah,
5's my favorite number.
So I find that amazing. Like, I mean, I take portraits of people all the time, and sometimes it's, you know, the test image. Like, you know, first, they're kind of unconsciously themselves, you know, or the very last image. I remember photographing a director and I've gone, yep, I've got it. It was that last shot. And she was just like, really? And I was like, yep. And when I showed her all the proof, she was like, was that the last shot? Because that's my favourite. And I went, yeah. And it was just this weird moment of, like, I don't know, everything coming together. But I think the fact that you're like, 5, this is my number, this is it's really, really interesting, you know? Like, wow, I don't think I could do that.
I mean, there's plenty of other stuff beforehand.
Totally.
But that all just goes
straight
to the bin.
Yeah. It's like you don't even, like, if we were back in film days, you wouldn't even put the roll of film in. You just, you know, it's there, as you say, as a mechanism to ground them yourself, get used to that, I guess, interaction and relationship, of trusting you to take the portrait at the right moment to have, as you, you know, especially if there are lights and all those kind of things. It's pretty confronting, I think, for people.
Absolutely. And it's also about, like, so there's kind of a whole process within there about the language of photography as well. So with the take and the shoot and all of these very,
really,
like,
violent words, right?
Violent words, yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, we get to that end and it's, we're making something together. So we're making this impression and it's the ownership and the agency of the person saying, yes, we can do this together, and like total ownership of that moment. Like, it's really quite powerful. And then when they name their image with their hashtag, it's like, oh my God. Like, it's really.
How did you come up with that idea? Like, so obviously it's hashtag I am woman as the project, but then, the fact that you gave them back that right to, like, create their own hashtag. How did you come up with that idea?
Oh, you know, I just come up with random stuff. No, it was actually
artist
just
instinct.
About artist instinct. No, I don't know. It really came back from taking, like, having that ownership back. So it was, you know, there's always these kind of hashtags that happen on social media, like, you know, these empowerment words or, you know, all of that stuff, like, which is, works really beautifully for some people, others not so much. I probably fall into the latter category. But it was just kind of, life has sort of been really, since, you know, the onslaught of social media, life has really been sort of kind of congested into these, or condensed, sorry, into these moments of, like, hashtags of, you know, that's kind of the representation of your feeling, your emotion, or your day, or your person. And so it was kind of just playing with that, but then trying to reposition that, trying to put that back. So as we were talking before about the political in the portraiture and in photography and also political in public space. So a lot of these portraits are presented back in public space. So there'll be big images in public spaces. So public space is such a political space. It's like who's allowed in there, who's seen, how's the safety, you know, the lighting. It's very, well, like Eileen Morton Robinson talks about the white possessive, and also with talking about bodies on the beach and how, you know, we think about the beach culture as being this kind of tanned, blonde, you know.
Totally.
whatever it is of Australian identity. But that's been happening through a performative mechanism of white people being on the beach, and that's what we're seeing all the time. So, you know, beaches around this continent have always been the domain of the blackfella, you know. It's beach culture, you know. it's been totally. Beach culture for 60,000 years. So, you know, we've had these like last couple of hundred years of the white possessive of that culture. So, you know, public space itself, like you see the representation in those public spaces of certain types of people, certain ages of people, genders. It's kind of that still that same performativity of keep placing something out there and then that becomes the norm. So if we can kind of flip that and flip that script and put our own faces back out there and take back those places where we're not really sort of allowed or, you know, seen or, you know,
or feel safe.
Safety-wise. Yeah, yeah. Or feel safe. Yeah. Then we're,
yeah,
we're taking those small moments of that performativity to then reposition those spaces and reimagine what they can be.
So what was it like when, for either yourself, because I know you've put your self-portrait out in one of those big spaces. I love that you call it big faces in public spaces. It's such a catchy, another great catchy title, but also it's just so simple in its concept. You become bigger than us as individuals walking along those spaces, you know, especially like if it's in a metro tunnel art, or I think the one that I saw of yours was for the ACME exhibition, The Goddesses. Is that what was it called? The Goddess exhibition, yeah. And, you know, you were huge. And I think one of the documentation shots you did, you know, you've got all these people kind of walking underneath you or through, and you kind of, when you look at the documentation shot, it's like all I can see are your eyes. Like it's just fabulous. And it's like, why aren't all these people looking at you? You know, like how are they just walking through, you know? But what does it feel like to have yourself in a public space, or even for any of these women that were part of that project, to then go and see themselves literally on the big screen kind of thing, you know, like out in the cinema of the world? What did it feel like?
It's Oh, look, it's a roller coaster of emotions.
okay.
It really is.
You're not dancing going, woo, you know, this is me.
You do. It's kind of all of those things, but it's also grappling with positioning yourself so large in a space it's kind of quite confronting. But
yeah, okay.
Then it's like those moments where you're like, yeah, you know, I'm an aging woman. you know, we're all aging in this world. So it's yes. like, yeah. And I'm also like, you know, an Indigenous woman. So it's like you kind of, that's a face that's not usually represented. So you instantly start like, you know, that internal dialogue starts picking away at what you see, what's there, what's presented. But the fact that that happens, like I'm very comfortable with who I am and how I look and moving into my next stage of life and all of that sort of jazz, whatever. It's like, you know, aging is actually a privilege. It's not a
totally,
bad thing.
Totally a privilege, yes.
It's like that, those moments where like having that kind of internal tension of seeing my face in that space really was actually, a moment where it was reinforcing for me that there is still a problem, like in the world, like with representation and who is seen and how is that seen. So the fact that someone who can feel quite comfortable about who they are would still feel kind of uncomfortable about seeing themselves is really still about that mirror that we're presented of what is acceptable and what is not acceptable as a kind of visual or person in the public sphere. Yeah.
Yeah. I find that really interesting because I think a lot of my work tries to do a similar kind of thing where it's about creating space to make images of myself or of transcultural people that may not feel comfortable in spaces, as you say. But I also think it is that thing, and I did it, you know, I came through my PhD journey and I remember at one point kind of going, what am I doing? Why am I doing this, you know? Do people really care about Eurasian identity? And I had someone say, imagine if you had had someone ahead of you that had written something about it or made artwork and you got to see it. Wouldn't you be excited? And I was like, yeah, I would really, like, that would have been incredible to just have someone in Australia doing that before me. And they said, well, then you're going to be that person for the next person. And I think that is really true. I think a lot of us are so used to seeing, as you say, you know, a very stereotypical white, blonde, tanned, slim, young person on billboards, on our social media, on our TV screens. And so shifting that and showing other people that they can be in those spaces too, or they can be valued, is so important. And as you say, it doesn't happen that often. Like, it's us artists having to do that labor a lot of the time.
Yeah, definitely. And it's also, you know, putting myself out there is, I had no intention of putting myself out there initially. So I had been shortlisted for that commission for Goddess, and the day I was going to be making the images with somebody else, that person was really sick.
Oh, like, no. They had COVID. So okay.
Being a poor artist, I was like, I really want my shortlist thing. So I've got to put in something. So I went through and kind of just started interrogating how I would feel in that moment. So the work, that particular work, was about reimagining Jeddah, which was the first Australian film in colour created by Charles Cheval. And it was the first...
I don't know the film. Okay,
yeah. Cool. So it was also the first film that showed, like, had Aboriginal leads, but showed them as kind of, you know, humans, not just these kind of, you know, performative natives. I'm using my hashtags. Inverted commas, yeah. So it was a really amazing film. I mean, there's problematic moments in there, yes, but it was kind of reimagining what would be my Jeddah moment. Mm. Like, so I'd gone through that process of reimagining that Jeddah moment with the collaborator I was going to be working with, and theirs was very different to what mine turned out to be, so which was interesting. But it was kind of, you know, I went through this whole kind of process of, once again, the performativity and performative acts of making and being and pretending and, you know, all of that. And, yeah, sort of, you know, threw on a possum skin the wrong way. So it looked wrong. I set up kind of this outdoor space in my studio with plants and stuff and lots of blue lights. And so it was replicating this moment in Jeddah which the lead Jeddah was performed by Annie Rosalie Kunith Monks, who passed recently, I think it was 2021. So that was like, there was this moment in Jeddah where Jeddah kind of had this like realization for this culture that she lost and hadn't experienced and didn't know, and was like this longing, lusting for moment. So it was lots of blue light in that. And so that was kind of the connecting back to Jeddah there. And just my moment was like, I have no idea what to do with this possum pelt. Like, yeah. What do I do with that? Like, I'm just going to put it on, like, you know, I'm some like 1930s, you know, movie star or whatever. Yeah. So it was thinking, so it was more playing on that moment of like, well, these are things that have been kind of taken away from cultures growing up on this continent, which there's a lot of reclamation occurring now, and people are sort of relearning. And, you know, the wonderful Aunty Vicky Cousins has been, you know, working really hard on the possum skin cloaks. And, yeah, so that was my moment of like, I'm just, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. So this, I really would like to know, but I'm, yeah, probably not. But that was kind of moving into that Jeddah moment. And Tracy Moffat did a beautiful short film called Night Cries, which starred Marcia Langdon. And that was kind of her response to Jeddah as well.
So there
was
lots of
moments in that I was kind of thinking of Charles Cheval's work as well as Tracy Moffat's commentary back to it. So, yeah, so there was lots to draw on there. And I was really glad that that was a process that made me start putting myself in front of the camera more often, like to really flow into the rest of my work that's been coming since.
That's a really nice point of putting yourself out in public space and putting yourself into your work more, and that idea of performativity of the self. The thing that I love about self-portraiture as a photographer is that you kind of subvert the gaze when you are your own subject. And I think as women, and for me as a Eurasian woman, that was really powerful as a mechanism, and something that I really did kind of, I guess, claim a little bit in my PhD, was like, actually, it has to be me representing myself in this frame, because it's my experience, it's my skin, it's my... I'm the person that gets judged, like, superficially every day of my life when I walk through the world. So I think self-portraits can be a really beautiful way and a really potent way of self-expression. How do you feel about, you know, leaning more into this and as an Indigenous woman putting yourself out there? And I think for me the most recent project that only just came down on the weekend was a series of self-portraits of yourself for Photo 2024 at Cunegat Hand Gallery, but also across Marybeck, and it had the best title. Would you be able to tell us what the title is and explain it, how it came about and its meaning?
Yep, sure. So the title was Flowing with the Future, Surviving Batman. So, yeah, that project was just one of those ones where I kind of listened to my intuition and sort of really listened to what I was doing, like, across the process of this making. So that project kind of came about. I'll step it back a bit. So I guess the thing with the self-portraiture really was not necessarily about self-portraiture for me in terms of that putting myself out there. It was looking at a different way of kind of looking at creating a collaborative portrait. So
yeah, wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, so the kind of all the other portraits I'd been making had been kind of these collaborative portraits. You know, the eye-to-eye work was, you know, we'd go through like three sessions of yarning together before we'd actually make a photo, and we'd co-design what that photo was going to look like and then set that up and make it. So it was kind of, how do you then kind of create these collaborative portraits and processes when you're not working with people and can't see people? So that kind of came out of that whole COVID era of, like, which kind of shifted my work. So that was really the thought process about the self-portraiture. And then that collaborative moment of I'm collaborating with everything that's around me, but also my emotion, my reaction, my history, my memory, my, you know, senses. So it became sort of an entire sensory process of how does that collaboration occur and then come into a print on an image. So I was sitting on the beach in La Trueta, and that was on Tom Gein country at Sisters Beach. And I was kind of going through all these processes of memory and connection and feeling this like deep calmness about sitting somewhere where that meant so much to me, that was part of my DNA. So I was thinking, how do I then create this kind of collaborative process with that part of country? So that's where the lumen prints came about. So I started creating lumen prints, and I had no idea what I was doing. I went and YouTubed it, like,
love
how do you do a lumen print? So I kind of, you know, made those, but, you know, made that with country in terms of collecting foliage from country and then placing that onto the paper and letting, you know, the sun expose that, but then placing that foliage back into the exact spot where it had been kind of taken from. So not using that kind of research process as an extractive mechanism, but using it as a collaborative process.
Yeah.
And then kind of fixed that imprint of on the paper via the salt water from Sisters Beach, which I collected next to a 10,000-year-old fish trap. So that was kind of thinking about those moments of, like, you know, this water holds memory, it holds emotion. There's only so much water in the world. It's always like, you know, we're never going to have more and we're never going to have less. So that water has been a connector between my childhood to my adulthood to my ancestors to, you know, my immediate kin. That water has been there and touched it. So that was kind of that thinking, okay, that's probably the closest I'm ever going to get to, you know, a lot of the old people. So that kind of became those lumens. And then coming back to Melbourne, kind of thinking through the process of what to do with those, I thought, well, how do I keep hold of that sort of feeling of that connection, of that collaboration, of that being on country, that calmness now that I'm not there? So that was kind of the idea, to place those lumens onto fabrics and then create a series of clothing that was then going into these other self-portraits. So the clothing itself, like, I ended up sewing, designed up and sewed. So they look pretty dodgy, but, you know, it's, by the end of it, I worked out how to use the machine again. Yeah. but that was, yeah. So then those moments of wearing that clothing then kind of informed making the next lot of portraits. And so the work that I was making was part of Future River, which was curated by Kimber Thompson for Coonahan Gallery. So Future River is all about waterways and water and the colonial obstructions which exist across everywhere on this nation. So thinking through that, it was like, you know, we've got Melbourne right behind us, you know, and like the founding father, I'm using my inverted commas again, of Melbourne was John Batman. John Batman back in La Truita was a bounty hunter. He was not a very nice person. So he's come from the land of my birth to the land that I'm now living, yet he's kind of, you know, changed his narrative from this bounty hunter to this, you know, revered human, even though now history is kind of not looking at him the same way, but for a very long time, you know.
And we still live with the legacy of that, I think. I think that's the thing that we're all grappling with.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a Batman Street just a couple of blocks away, which is like, what?
Yeah.
But, yeah, so, I mean, that's one major colonial blockage that we have, is those structures, that city, that kind of covering up of country with concrete and barbed wire and buildings and, you know, all the things where you're not kind of physically touching anymore. It's changed waterways. It's like reconstructed what it should be. So thinking of that as a colonial blockage and, you know, the relationship between Batman and my home back in La Truita, it was really thinking about that journey that he took, which when he first arrived onto Kulin country, he came through Williamstown and down the Maribyrnong River and landed at Grimes Reserve in Footscray, which is just next to Footscray Community Arts Centre. So that was his first point of landing before he went into what is now called Melbourne. So went into the Burrung. So kind of thinking about that journey, I'm living in Footscray. My studio is like, you know, 200 metres away from that waterway that he would have travelled. I go to Williamstown all the time to walk the dog. You know, it's like I kind of feel like that's this sort of circular process of this entangled history, this moments of, well, he's created this sort of legacy over here, but I'm still here. And Aboriginal people from across Tasmania are still here. So where, you know, it's just this moment of performativity once again, placing myself in those images, wearing those outfits and reclaiming or reperforming what could actually be like a future narrative. So flowing with the future, it's, you know, we need to remember the past to remember the future, as Bell Hooks talks about. But it's also that flowing with rather than against, which sort of staying with the trouble of Donna Haraway. So it's kind of not sort of trying to change anything in a sort of really cataclysmic sort of process. It's about those small incremental moments of change that can then become a wider sort of process of change.
Yeah, wow. That's really fascinating to hear that. Thank you for sharing all that, because I think, you know, when I looked at the images, again, you know, you're talking about the scale, like, and some of them, like, you just can't not look at your eyes. Like, it's like you're showing me history in a moment, you know. But even the ones where, like, your face is covered, like, I think of the one where the fabric is covering your head, and They're just beautiful images. I love the swans. I love even and that calmness of you of saying, you know, you're sitting on the beach, but then the one in front of Counihan Gallery where you're sitting, I think cross-legged, and it's just so calm and it's so centered and grounded that they actually transport you, I think, as you say, like back and forth, like back through history, but then also thinking about maybe a future history. You know, like you're marking time, you're marking moments, you're marking your people, and there's a quietness and a gentleness to them. And I think that knowing that history and understanding that journey actually even makes them even more potent and really important. But they don't, when you encounter them, they don't necessarily tell you all that history. So I want to say thank you for sharing that, because I didn't have that. I didn't know fully that story. I kind of knew what it alluded to, but the fact that also that you've made that journey in a different way, but they're still here, I think is a really, really wonderful sentiment.
Thank you.
Your work always seems to have an aspect of materiality in it, or I think you in your bio you said new materialism or new with a K. How have you found that? And maybe I'm not sure if that's a kind of research PhD thing, but how has that kind of material aspect and the tactile aspect kind of woven through, whether it's through films and installations that you've done? I'm thinking of the one Against the Wind, or, you know, like there's certain ones there, you've got projection, you've got, yeah, they're all really layered, but they feel very textural.
Yeah, I guess, you know, materiality. I guess if we talk about, well, the new or known, so new with K and known with K, materialism is really pushing back against that kind of moment of post-humanism.
Okay.
Kind of, it's positioning knowledge back into a Eurocentric position of post-humanism, which they keep talking about like they, you know, that's not what it is, but it's actually old knowledge. It's known knowledge that they're talking about. And it's just reappropriation again. So Zoe Todd, who is an amazing academic and writer from Turtle Island, Canada, talks about this kind of process of post-humanism and new materialism being kind of this new appropriation of old knowledge. So it's kind of playing on those processes. So where I've come to with that is that I'm working with known knowledge. I'm working with old stuff that's either deep within me or it's part of the stories that people share, like these kind of collective networks of moments that, you know, really feeds into that kind of understanding of known materialism. I guess also the materiality, like the physical materiality of things. It's really about bringing in those senses, like to understand that we're not just privileging sight or sound. It's like we've kind of got, you know, we've got other senses. So it also plays on those ideas of what is feminine, working with material. So, you know, we've been pushed into these kind of concepts of feminine is soft and flowing and blah, blah, blah. So it's like, whatever. But, you know, people understand that as a kind of a concept. So whether it's a reality or it's not a reality, it does soften. It does give a tactility to a work. And so with Against the Wind, like that particular work, that was a collaborative process with two Indigenous dancers who choreographed their own movements to five prompts, five once again.
I love this number. This is great.
Five prompts that I gave them, and they each kind of, you know, developed these like 2-minute choreographed movements to each of those prompts, which we filmed and then, you know, put into this work. So that was kind of layered with light onto materials. And then you kind of got this kind of flowing motion and a 3D sort of feeling to it. It felt more present than just something that was a solid wall. So working with that softness and kind of, you know, the body of a person into that. I worked through my own reaction to those five prompts as well and filmed the other section of that work. So this work was a 7-channel video work. So it was like,
wow.
So
huge.
Six of the channels were projected onto structures which had the material on them, and the 7th channel was the main video, which was kind of a cinematic process of what is my actual standpoint. So that was that projection, and worked around those five things. Yeah. And so I guess material, creating things that are sort of can be looked at from different positions as well. So you're never just looking at it from one view. And so that's kind of reinforcing that moment that we've all got different views, and that's going to change with different points in time, you know, age, day, whatever, you know. But if we're all looking at things from a different way, we're never seeing something exactly the same. So it's also playing on that as well. I'm not articulating that well, but.
No, I think that I totally understand what you're trying to say. And I think it's a really important thing to note as photographers, as makers, you know, just acknowledging different perspectives, different voices, and as you say, across time and place, really. And even within ourselves, you know, we're allowed to change and shift and meld to things and age and be valued for it and be valued for the different perspectives. Thank you so much, Jody, for coming today and spending time chatting to me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Bea, for the invitation. And it was a highlight of my day to get to talk to you.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
This episode was recorded on the unceded lands of the Dja Dja Wurrung country in the Macedon Ranges. I want to pay my respects to the traditional owners of this beautiful land, past and present. It always was and always will be Aboriginal land. This episode was produced by Pia Johnson. Sound engineer is Alex Edward. Music by Steph O'Hara and graphic design by Brent Lederitz.